that those whose slaughter we were aiding and abetting deserved better, much, much better than us.
Been listening to Mitchell S. Jackson read from Survival Math.
Man, I like that paragraph.
Yeah.
I'm like, man, I'm glad I wrote that.
That's great. Yeah, no, it's amazing. So I want to push on this question around fiction and nonfiction.
Okay.
Because you've traveled an interesting circuitous route around mm-hmm. this story. So your first book, the novel The Residue Years, is a fictionalized version of you and your mom growing up in North Portland.
Yeah.
And when you were asked why you didn't write it as memoir, mm-hmm. your answer is often pretty complex and multifaceted. So yeah. For instance, in the Rumpus interview, you give four reasons. One, that you began writing it in prison, and since you weren't yet a reader, you mainly knew of novels mm-hmm. and you weren't yet familiar with the world of memoir mm-hmm. and what that was about. Two, that you didn't want people to recognize themselves
yeah.
or to get in trouble if you were writing about someone who was still dealing drugs, mm-hmm. for instance. Three, that once you started studying writing, you felt like you needed fiction's latitude to figure out how to tell a story.
Mm-hmm.
And four, you definitely didn't want to be pigeonholed as a person with one story who could put that one story down but not be seen as someone who could write.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, after you write the fiction book,
mm-hmm.
you then make a nonfiction documentary
yeah.
where that explores the autobiographical details of the book.
Yeah.
You talk to your mom about her drug problem. You visit the guy you first gave drugs to in prison,
mm-hmm.
and you do a reading in the prison where you were incarcerated.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have your memoir
mm-hmm.
That returns to your family in North Portland in full-on nonfiction mode.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess this is a long-winded way to ask about this journey mm-hmm. and what made you realize that after having done the novel and after having done the documentary, that there is still something that you wanted to do specifically as memoir yeah. around the same story.
Yeah, those things are, I still believe those things in the rumpus about the reasoning, or maybe it was even the rationale for writing The Residue Years as fiction. I actually imagined Survival Math as essays. And I make in my mind what's a clear distinction between essay and memoir. To me, memoir is a kind of long narrative, right, that centers around, you know, there's like a main character in a memoir. And to me, the essay is a discrete examination of an idea. And so I imagine each of these, what are chapters, as actually standalone essays, which, because they're also grounded in the experiences of people that I know, they are connected in that sense. So you could read it, I think, as a memoir, but people who go into this reading it as a memoir, I think it invites a misread because you're looking for a long narrative and you won't get one. Why I chose essay is because when The Residue Years was on submission to editors, I told my agent at the time to send me the rejections. And, you know, they were like standard. We love it. We don't think we can find a place for it. We love it. But one of the rejections was this, and I have this quote here. I felt that the combination of intellectual references and street slang and Champ's voice came off sounding oddly implausible, as original as it is. And that one struck me because it seemed like he was making an assumption about my intellectual capabilities. Because Champ, I always imagined as like a kind of me on steroids, like a smarter, more witty, more funny person, but still me. And that this editor could not imagine that a person could have these experiences and then have these kind of intellectual curiosities was a real like jab to me and my identity. And so one of the reasons why I chose essay, maybe even the most important, is because it forces you to reckon with the writer's ideas. And I was like really, really set on like, well, I'm not gonna let them dismiss my mind in this next work. So that is two things. One, I think to read these each as a discrete idea, right? Like American Blood, they're like the people who we put up under our boot might be the most patriotic, that, you know, matrimony, that a long-term drug addiction could also be viewed as like a marriage and fidelity to a commitment, right? So these, to me, they're all like distinct ideas, and I wanted people to like, okay, well, where do I stand in position to this, but not just to be looking for the story, which I know that there's a lot, I mean, in writing features, right, I usually start with anecdote or vignette, and so it's the same way with the essays, right? So I'm starting with story, and I'm ending usually with story, so I can see how people would kind of make the inference that this is a kind of a longer narrative.
I feel like we're getting more and more, I don't know if you'd call this a memoir in essays or not, or maybe that's just a marketing term, but like Melissa Phoebos's Abandon Me, for instance, feels also like it's, she calls it memoirs, but they also feel like they're standalone essays at the same time, and yet there's something that travels through them.
Yeah.
It's similar with survival math.
Yeah.
If we return to your reasons for writing Residue Years as fiction in the rumpus, how did you reconcile yourself to your fear of people recognizing themselves in survival math, particularly people who might still be dealing drugs or pimping, or someone who maybe in the past you portray as committing a robbery, or even if they're not doing something illegal, just maybe somebody who feels shame about something.
You know, I don't think I ever really reconciled with that. The person that I was most worried about was my mother, and we had some long talks before it was published about what I'd written about, and even because we were working on the documentary while I was still publishing, so she had already shared stories with me that she knew was going to be public because they were going to be on film, and you know, that's a different thing too. Now we know what you look like, and so she at a certain point said to me, like, if this is going to help someone, then you know, I'm willing to do this. I joked last night that my mom was my top research assistant for survival math, and 2 weeks ago, I ran a story. Well, actually, so the Harper's and the New Yorker ran stories from, or essays from, survival math, and the Harper's people hit me about the fact check, and I'm like, okay, here, take these numbers. And I didn't hear any more. I don't even actually know if they fact checked. I imagine that they did, because they're Harper's. But last week, really like maybe the week before, but going into last week, because it published, I believe, on Monday, the New Yorker, they ran a story on my mother's addiction, the matrimony essay / chapter, and they had to fact check her the details, right? So they were like, we need your mom. So I didn't even think about this, but like, those are triggers for an addict, right? To have to recall where you were and how much drug you use. And I wasn't privy to the conversation, but my mom called me back and she was like, wow, like, why would they do that? Like, why would they need all of those answers? Like, why would they ask all of those questions? And I was like, damn, like, I just put my mom through some trauma to publish an essay. And that made me sad that not only had I asked her the questions to actually make the essay, but that then they were coming back and asking her to verify. And then they wanted me, so I use pseudonyms when I think the people, it could be harmful to them and we don't have a close relationship. And so the person who exposed my mom to drugs for the first time was one of her good friends, and they wanted to interview her, and I was like, that's where I draw the line. Like, I'm not recruiting another person for you to interrogate them. Like, I don't know what space they're in. And so they ended up cutting, they had to change some of the language around that. But I was just thinking, like, wow, my mom is so generous to do this for me, and also that I've like put her through something. While I've been here, one of the things about the survival files is that they are anonymous, right? So I never identify which story belongs to which person.
Well, maybe before you go further, tell people who haven't read the book what a survivor file is.
Yes.
Because this is another way, kind of like the Cento and kind of like the prologue, that you bring in other voices that aren't your voice.
Yes. So the book cover features 16 men from my family, And those are portraits that I shot a few years ago. I was actually staying in the tin house when I shot those. Yeah, so most of those photos are taken in the tin house. And I ask each of the men that I photographed the same question: what's the toughest thing you've survived? And then I write their stories, or transform their stories into second person narratives. And there's several reasons why I did that. One, they kind of were born out of the inception of the Black Lives Matter movement, and particularly with how young black men were being portrayed, the victims, right? Like, he was dangerous, or he was wearing a hood. And I wanted to visually decontextualize black men and say, if you just look him in his eye with none of these kind of cues, does he look dangerous to you? And then why does he look dangerous to you? And then I wanted to use the second person because I think that it is both, it has the intimacy of a first person narrative, but it also invites the reader to imagine themselves as the protagonist. So I wanted the reader to get as close to that experience as I thought that they could, and thought that, well, this might be a disparate experience from what my readers could imagine. And I thought a second person invited them to do that. So not even the men who are in the book know whose story is who. They only know their story. So they're like, oh, is that? I'm like, I can't tell you.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, but.
But they're all 16 were okay with their story being in the book.
Right. So, but I received a call yesterday from a family member of one of them who recognized themselves in the story and was upset that they told the story. And I'm like, well, I can't even identify to you whether or not you're right. I'm like, listen, I promised everyone anonymity, but this person was actually hurt. Like, why wouldn't you come to me and talk to me about this? And I'm like, but that's not how this works.
So when we arrive periodically through the book, we arrive at survival file sections.
Yes,
and we see
four
these
sections.
We see these amazing photographs, mm-hmm. and we get the stories.
Yeah.
They're not corresponding the stories to the photographs.
No.
Can we hear one of the files?
Yeah, sure. You're out one night at the weekend hot spot off too many straight shots to count, and therefore the kind of faded you swear manifold you're funny when you hear a dude you don't know say, blood, to cap a sentence. Damn, I didn't know people were still gangbanging, you say, and search the nearest faces for mirth. But don't nobody smile nor laugh, and in fact, dude smacks you upside your dome as if your joke was his cue. In an instant, the two of you take to scrapping inside the club, while neighborhood dudes whose account could damage your rep bear witness, and you best him before being wrenched apart and bounced outside. He paces one way, you pace the other, and in the distance between you lies the tacit truth that the animosity is in no way squashed. The next day, your friend is hosting your brother's moving to New York barbecue fish fry, and you show up hours prior, dump a shoebox carrying your Uzi and nine on the living room table, and shout to the group of gathered men and God, I heard people was looking for me. Well, let them know. I ain't hard to find. Somebody gonna die. In your mid-30s, you'll bust one shot near, but just near, your father inside your crib, not to kill him, but to discourage him from discouraging you against prosecuting what might be your last ballistic beef. But on this day, you're in your late 20s, which in this case is plenty old enough to die. You stomp out of the house and slam yourself into a car driven by your ride to beyond good sense girlfriend. Your brother calls and cautions you against doing something you'll regret, and furthermore against returning to the barbecue fish fry. Hours after his call, you flout your disinvitation, which is to say you show up and stalk the yard with a waist tuck nine bulging under your t-shirt and a scowl that ain't got no place near nothing festive. You see a dude who witnessed your scuffle the night before, a dude who's a friend of your new foe, and you flash your nine and threaten him into the basement. You lay your pistol in plain view and seethe. We can scrap right here, right now, you say. Nah, bro. I don't want no problems, he says and warns. Your newest archer's foe heard word of your whereabouts and is on his way to the barbecue fish fry for action. By now, almost everyone wants you to leave, including the father of the friend who's hosting, and it's the father's wish you decide to heed. Oh, the timing. You stomp out of the yard, peer down the street, and in the distance see your new arch foe among a circle of dudes. You pull your pistol from your waist, and men, women, and God's only begotten son be damned, march into the middle of the street. Once, you told a grade school teacher of your plan to become a hitman, and though you haven't considered that career choice in ages, today could be the day that delivers you to the threshold of that young hope. Before you shoot yourself into that fate, a girl you know from high school darts between you and your new foe. She calls your name, pleads, please don't, please. She announces your fast foe as her brother appeals once more against gunplay, and you pause, seeing an escape out of what a breath before felt destined. Oh, that's your brother, you say? And lower your pistol. The next week, you pull into the parking lot of the grocery store with your daughter in the passenger seat, and out of some place unseen, your foe pulls up beside you. Neither hand touches the wheel, and you bet blood on why they aren't in view and what one holds. Decisions, of which the most fool would be to reach for what's under your seat. Your daughter is a fifth grader, which is to say, in this instance, plenty old enough to die. You curl over her embrace, and when you don't hear a pistol bark, you raise your head, shake it. No, 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 no. No, 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 no. Look your foe eye to assassin black eye and mouth, man, I don't want no problems. It's squashed. It's squashed. He idles for what could be the rest of your and your firstborn's life.
We've been listening to Mitchell S. Jackson read from Survival Math. So I wanted to return to one of the reasons you wrote the novel first, which you said was so you wouldn't be pigeonholed as a writer with one or a person with one story and not actually a writer. And you've talked before about how white the publishing and the literary world is and how few people of color were in your writing programs. Mm-hmm. And about your fear that, in your words, here's another black guy who has a hard knock story.
Yeah.
And your response was to say, I have to get to a point where they have to look at this writing and say, this is good writing, and he just happens to be telling this story.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously with how incredibly crafted the structure of this book is and unique the voice and the syntax, and you've been recognized with the Whiting Award and you have the admiration of all of these literary luminaries, you've obviously achieved this and more. But I was reading your Facebook page this last week, and you were going to be speaking or doing a reading.
And
you put the bios of your fellow readers up on your page. And so here are some of the bios of your fellow readers. One was a multilingual poet, novelist, and translator whose work has been published in Spain, Mexico, Costa Rica, Nicaragua, Italy, France, and India. And then another one was one of contemporary poetry's most gifted lyric poets. And then your bio was, grew up in a neglected neighborhood in Portland, Oregon, where his life and the lives of those around him were shadowed by the crack epidemic. Jackson was almost a casualty of those circumstances when he went to prison for selling drugs. And I guess I was curious about your desire to inoculate yourself by being an exceptional writer, then being an exceptional writer, and yet still sort of encountering this. Nevertheless, is this, well, I want to hear your thoughts on that on their own right, but I also wondered, is this a rare occurrence, or has the inoculation been partially successful? Or are you seeing this sort of racial coding all the time, despite the fact that you're obviously are making art?
I'm seeing it all the time, and it's interesting to me because I would say that the publishing industry prides itself on being liberal. It's not just the bio. I mean, that was a big hoopla, and You know, I probably could have handled it differently. I didn't. I guess that was a marker to me of the power of social media, because I wrote that and hundreds of people responded and started tweeting, and it really became bigger than I anticipated. And I should also say that I went to that university and had a really good time, and the people that I met there were like very cordial. It was like a really great experience. But it's not just that. It's like, I won't mention any names, but like, I have in the, you know, last 2 or 3 weeks, I mean, done 20 interviews, you know, published 3-4 excerpts, and in a few of those cases, I have seen even the headline or the subhead that they're going to run the story with, and I'm like, you can't do that. Like, that's offensive. And I don't even know why I have to point that out to you, that that's offensive. You know, like, you can't run a headline that says, my mother smokes crack. Like, I don't know. You can't do that. You know, yeah. Like, would you write that about your mama and put it up on online? And then I'm like, wow, like, but these are the people that are supposed to be the most empathetic. These are the people that are, you know, progressives, liberals. Like, this sound like white supremacy. And I'm not calling them white supremacists. I'm just saying, to my mind, it feels, it really causes me to worry that the people who I think are as close to allies as I can get can't see me.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And it does not matter. You know, they did it to Obama, so of course they're going to do it. You know, like, you just work your way on down the line. So I think, you know, black people always say, like, once, if you are N-I-G-G-A, you always are, right? And it doesn't matter your level of success. And, you know, this could be, it's in the writing, it's institutional, right? There's also, like, I have been in meetings at institutions where people, a room full of English professors, and one person comes up to me and says, wow, like, you're really articulate. And I'm like, well, like, we're English professors, you know? So, like, it's inescapable.
Yeah.
And I really feel it, you know, in the publishing industry, but I also feel it in these like elite institutions.
It kind of makes me think back to this white incuriousness around history and place and where we are in space, but also the way in which we can be in the same space and not be inhabiting not only the same stories, but even the same physical places where we go.
Yeah.
Like for another interview that I'm preparing for in the future, I've been looking back at the conflict between Tony Hoagland and Claudia Rankine.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And Major Jackson wrote an interesting response that was partially in response to that, but it was prompted by it, but it was about why don't white people write about race in their poetry?
Mm-hmm.
And then one of the things he was presuming was that when they do, it's usually a poem of what he calls a poem of encounter, because the white poet doesn't have any friends or like sort of everyday experiences with black people. So it's a poem of encountering a black person on the subway or encountering a black person here or there. And that makes me wonder if like that sort of segregated everyday experience would potentially, not to excuse the responses of these subtitles, but maybe the exotification of the other as encounter rather than as person.
Yeah, I mean, it has to be some kind of inaccessibility, right? And that's what you get when it's an encounter, because it's just, you know, you don't have enough time to see humanity. So I, you know, on the one hand, it's like I recognize it and I want to fight it at every turn, right? If that's just me saying, no, I want to edit this hit. I mean, there was a story that ran with a headline. My agent sent me the email, and I was doing something else, so I saw it late, and they were like, oh, they're trying to run this afternoon. Like, and so I was like, oh, no, they can't use that. Like, no, let me give you some options. And I'm just off the top of my head, like, I don't want them to run with this, but I better give them some options or this is going to run. So she was like, oh, yeah, these are better, Mitch. I'll forward this along. Then I don't know, maybe a Google alert or something. So they ran the story with the headline that they sent me that I said no to. And then I saw, I was like, oh my God. I was like, what happened? And she's like, let me email her right now. And then they changed it immediately.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is not will you change it. The question is, what the hell did you see that made you write it in the first place, or what did you not see?
Right. Yeah. No. Yeah. I think the second question is the one.
Yeah. So I want to be careful, like, that I'm not trying to convict people as being, you know, bigots or anything. I just think that, like, there, I hope that it's not a chasm, but, like, it feels often like there's a real chasm between even people who want to extend themselves, want to see you, just is there something between us and they can't see across that line.
Yeah. No, I want to talk more about whiteness and white spaces in this book.
Okay.
But before we do, I was hoping you do another really short reading.
Okay.
So for people who aren't from Portland, historically Alberta, Williams, and Mississippi were the black commercial districts.
Yes.
And a lot has changed in the last, particularly in the last 15 years.
Yeah.
So could you read?
It's early, right?
Yeah, it's on page 11 and 12.
Marcus, I'll close soon, but before I do, I must tell you about a not-so-long-ago day I cruised the arteries of this new city. Alberta, Mississippi, Williams Ave, saw on Alberta a staffing company and a yoga studio and restaurant bars. Saw cheery citizens lunching on a patio under the shade of tall trees and a vacant lot transformed into a scaled metropolis of food trucks. There was a clothing store and a bike shop and a sticker shop and a donut shop and a place that fixes guitars. That day I rode up and down Mississippi and saw a tattoo shop and a tea shop and an art gallery and a bookstore. Witnessed a shabby dude, the lone brown face for blocks in any direction, flitting to destination somewhere. Saw a cafe that sells crepes and a boutique that hawks high-end glasses. While wheeling the wide berth of an interminable-ass bike lane, I peeped a dude on a mountain bike in khakis and an Oxford shirt and a woman tattooed in plural on a cruiser. Every few feet, or so it seemed, construction crews were erecting odes to privilege. On Williams Ave, I beheld more miles of bike lanes and bike shops and bikers and the bike bar. There was an Art Deco hospital building under construction, and a bakery, and a hair studio, and a Pilates studio, and yet another damn yoga studio. There was a mother pushing a hooded stroller, and a couple traipsing the sidewalk hand in hand as if this world would never fail them. But what I didn't see on Williams Ave was a single black face any which way my head turned. Our absence made me question whether this new city is the yield of what they've sown or what we've reaped. It made me wonder if it's our just due from surrendering our hope too soon or dreaming pragmatic or mashing on somebody's baby girl all winter to glory new wheels down MLK and majestic summer brilliance, or being enchanted with colors, or transforming from one gang to the other, or copping a dope sack on consignment from a head start on prison big homie and posting all night on a dim side street for a few bucks, if even a buck, of profit, or seizing with a strap what don't belong to us, or flouting a second or third strike, or revolving to prison to serve a mandatory minimum stretch. I ask myself, could this new place, home, which seems so much the locus of our undoing, be the harvest of our collective deeds? The answer is yes. But the answer is also that you and me and the generations between and beyond us must refuse assuming the greatest weight for what this place has become. Because if these centuries attest to anything, it's to the incontrovertible truth that this ain't our Eden and won't be, for that was never their intent.
So what are we going to expect from Mitchell S. Jackson next? you have a survival math movie, right?
I do have it. I showed it at the Brooklyn Library. I still want to make some edits or revisions to it. Not edits. So I probably won't be like releasing it, but my next project, I just won this fellowship from the New York Public Library called a Coleman Fellowship, which is a year for me to be a scholar at the library. So I won't be teaching next year, which is the first time in 16 years I won't be teaching. And I'll be researching for my novel project, which is about a cult that existed in Oregon in the 1980s, a black cult. And so I'm writing about a cult leader, which really excites me because now I can do like my biblical research and, you know, like I'm really excited to like figure out what this voice sounds like on the page. So yeah, that's I mean, I started doing a little initial research, but I haven't really been writing much. But yeah, I'm really excited to get to that project.
I can't wait for that.
Yeah. I'm excited, man.
Thank you so much for being on the show, Mitchell.
Thank you. This is great.
Yeah.
This
We're talking today to Mitchell S. Jackson, the author of Survival Math. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Miller.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Listener-supported community radio. Stay tuned for Shocks of Sheba, up next after these headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy jueves 17 de junio del 2021. Los funcionarios de salud en África han pedido una aceleración urgente en el suministro de vacunas al continente para frenar una ola de infecciones por COVID-19 y la evolución de las nuevas variantes potencialmente peligrosas del mismo. Menos de una de cada 100 personas en el continente ha recibido una vacuna, lo que significa que es probable que las infecciones crecientes maten a decenas de miles. África necesita millones de dosis más aquí y ahora. África